The war, because it's very strange for me when European countries are shutting down the borders for people who are trying to escape from mobilization, because if these people would be able to escape the mobilization, then they won't be taking part in the war. Of course, yeah, they can be more brave and fight Putin by bare hands, but it's not possible to fight a police state. Putin has millions of police. And it's not easy to have a revolution. You cannot go just to Kremlin with your bare hands and have a revolution. It's not so easy to have a revolution in dictatorship where all media are controlled by government, where all independent media were declared foreign agents.
Arshak,
and had
we have
to
10
flee.
Seconds.
So, yeah.
We have 10 seconds, Arshak.
Yeah?
If you could finish your statement.
Yes. So Russian people, they don't support the war. They are afraid to oppose the war, I think.
Well, Arshak Makhijan, I want to thank you for being with us again. Your own citizenship in Russia is threatened to be revoked. Exiled Russian anti-war human rights activists in Berlin and Hanna Perekhoda. I want to thank you for joining us from Lausanne. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Biden will visit Portland tomorrow, hoping to give Democrats a boost. Early study of Oregon's drug decriminalization measure shows no impact on the number of police calls, and in national news, jurors in Florida give the Parkland mass shooter a life sentence, not the death penalty. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 13th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. President Joe Biden is set to visit Oregon tomorrow, staying through Saturday, where he's scheduled to attend a reception for Democratic governor candidate Tina Kotek, according to the White House. Biden's West Coast visit had him travel to Colorado and California before his arrival in Portland this Friday. The president will participate in a volunteer grassroots event with Oregon Democrats tomorrow before Kotek's reception over the weekend. Topics to be addressed include discussions following progress made from the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law in 2021 and the Inflation Reduction Act, which Biden signed into law in August. Democrats are also hoping Biden will discuss their pledges to protect abortion rights following the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. This is the second time this year Biden has visited Oregon after coming to the state last April. Traffic advisories are in effect for both Friday and Saturday during the president's visit, with TriMet warning of major disruptions for both bus lines and the MAX starting at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning and lasting through 6 p.m. Saturday evening. Areas expected to be particularly impacted include downtown Portland and surrounding major roads and all transit routes between Portland International Airport and Gateway Transit Center. Traffic officials are advising motorists to be prepared to stop for periods in these areas when Biden or his motorcade are nearby. Updates on transit delays can be found on TriMet's website. But what do Democrats hope Biden can accomplish on his trip to the West? We go to KBOO's Josh Salem for more.
President Joe Biden visits three Western states this week. He stopped near Vail, Colorado yesterday, to sign a proclamation creating the Camp Hale Continental Divide National Monument. That action, extending long-term protections to federal lands, is of particular significance to Native Americans. It was done at the request of Democratic State Senator Michael Bennett, who was hoping to be reelected in November. The president then headed to California to promote his legislative achievements as well as headline a fundraiser for House Democrats. Biden plans to stop in Oregon tomorrow, at least partly in support of Tina Kotek, Democratic candidate for governor. Kotek's candidacy is being threatened by unaffiliated opponent Betsy Johnson, who has double-digit support in polling. If Johnson siphons enough votes from Kotek, Republican candidate Christine Drazen could win the race outright in November. Democrats everywhere are facing the traditional midterm antipathy toward the party seen to be in power. They are also dealing with rapidly rising inflation and presidential approval ratings that have remained extremely low. Democratic candidates have highlighted accomplishments such as bipartisan infrastructure expansion and a broad climate, tax, and healthcare package. They seem more likely to appear with Biden if it's an official White House event underscoring their specific achievements. In Oregon, Biden's political pull will be tested among Democratic voters. Whether or not he can consolidate Democratic support for Kotek remains to be seen. Republicans see their first real, recent opportunity to take the governor's mansion, not just because of Johnson's bid, but by pushing messages of homelessness and crime that have been major concerns for the state's voters. Jesse Hunt, a spokesman for the Republican Governors Association, says, quote, "Democrats are panicked. Their multi-decade grip on the governor's office is slipping away, as Christine Drazen connects with the majority of Oregon voters who yearn for change. The Democrat regime of Joe Biden, Kate Brown, Tina Kotek, and Betsy Johnson have done nothing to make Oregon safer or more prosperous," end quote. President Biden plans to be in Oregon tomorrow and Saturday. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Initial research on Oregon's drug decriminalization measure, Measure 110, doesn't show a correlation between the measure and increased calls for police service. That's according to the first results from RTI International, a nonpartisan research firm based in North Carolina that's been tasked with a four-year inquiry into Measure 110's impacts. The first data they've been able to measure is calls for service, or the amount of calls for police help over time. They found that despite what law enforcement across the state said that they felt was happening, that there was more property crime and vandalism happening, the numbers don't reflect that, at least in Portland. The researchers compared calls in Portland before and after Measure 110 went into effect, and they also compared Portland to other similar cities. There wasn't any noticeable increase in calls to police. That's important because a big topic of concern for folks in the midterm elections is the impact of Measure 110. It decriminalized drug possession and redirected significant amounts of marijuana tax revenue to substance abuse treatment services. The decriminalization started in February 2021, but the money for services only just started flowing about 3 months ago. Hope Smiley McDonald led the research by RTI International. She told Willamette Week, quote, "We're certainly going to be looking at overdose fatality data, but those data have a bit of a lag time. The main drivers of change in terms of substance use treatment and harm reduction services are not really in place yet. We're probably not really looking to see what that change looks like, at least for another year." Cycling advocates protested in southeast Portland Wednesday afternoon following the recent death of cyclist Sarah Pliner. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more on the story.
Wednesday afternoon, throngs of cycling advocates lined the intersection of Southeast Powell Boulevard and 26th Avenue, demanding improvements for bicyclist safety. The call for improved safety infrastructure at the heavily trafficked intersection follows the recent death of 50-year-old Sarah Pliner, who was hit by a semi-truck while biking in the area on October 4th. Protesters wore bright colors and formed human bike lanes and bike boxes, a feature the intersection had at one time before the city had them removed in 2018. The removal of the bike boxes was originally intended to encourage cyclists to use 28th Avenue as a transit route, a much tighter intersection at Powell. Other safety measures pressed for the intersection include changes in signaling, configuration, and cautionary signage in either direction. The Street Trust, a nonprofit that advocates for multimodal transportation safety, was one of the groups participating in Wednesday's protest. Street Trust spokeswoman Congresswoman Sarah Iannarone summed up the situation, saying, quote, "We really need to get into the minds of motorists passing through here that they need to be more aware," end quote. Any changes to the intersection will likely fall on the Oregon Department of Transportation, as Powell Boulevard is also Highway 26, which is controlled and maintained by ODOT. Following Pliner's death last week, ODOT released a statement saying the agency has put in several new crossing signals, added rapid flashing beacons, and made improvements with added signage and additional lighting along the busy street. ODOT Director Chris Strickler said earlier this week, quote, "This road cannot and should not function as a traditional highway anymore. It is time to make changes to ensure the safety of all users," end quote. Strickler also maintains that possible options to quickly transform Powell into a safer roadway are being evaluated. A community forum will be held on October 20th at 6 p.m. at Cleveland High School with representatives from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, ODOT, Portland Public Schools, and TriMet, attending to discuss swift and efficient changes to the traffic-heavy boulevard. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Several apartments were damaged by a two-alarm fire Wednesday evening that broke out at a complex near Northwest 185th Avenue and Southwest Baseline Road in Beaverton. Around 6 p.m., firefighters responded to a fire in a single unit at Aloha Park Apartments. When they arrived, the blaze had spread to several other units. Officials from Tualatin Fire and Rescue said 10 units had fire, smoke, and water damage, leaving 18 residents displaced. Those impacted in the fire included two residents who were evaluated for smoke inhalation, with one being hospitalized, and three dogs who died during the blaze. The fire shut down Northwest 185th Avenue southbound at Southwest Baseline Road for nearly 4 hours. Washington County Sheriff's Office reopened the roadway shortly before 10 p.m. Both Hillsborough and Portland fire crews assisted on the scene, while the Red Cross is helping the displaced residents. The official cause of the fire remains unknown, though fire experts are warning others to stay safe by not leaving cooking unattended and to be aware of the weather, especially amid October's currently hot and dry conditions. Washington State is establishing rules for the Climate Commitment Act, legislation that creates a cap-and-invest program in the state with the goal of reducing carbon emissions. Another part of the law aims to improve air quality for frontline communities. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Washington State is crafting its ambitious cap-and-invest law to reduce the state's emissions by 95% by 2050 and is seeking comments from the public. The Climate Commitment Act was passed in Olympia in 2021, and compliance begins in 2023. The measure aims to cut emissions by requiring businesses that emit at least 25,000 tons of carbon pollution to bid for allowances. David Mendoza with the Nature Conservancy in Washington says the program also includes air quality commitments for communities hit hardest by air pollution.
Emissions like particulate matter lead to negative health outcomes, higher rates of asthma, higher rates of heart disease, lower life expectancy. And so there's a very rigorous program that's being developed right now by the Department of Ecology to set air quality targets so that we are seeing a set and specified reduction in these harmful criteria pollutants.
The Department of Ecology is seeking public comment through November 4th as it develops rules for the program. The agency wants guidance on how to best identify communities overburdened by air pollution and where to invest in air monitors. It has scheduled some online public comment sessions, including today at 6 p.m. Mendoza says Washington has learned from California's cap and trade program, which has been criticized for not reducing pollution in overburdened communities.
The key component that differentiates our policy from California's and I think other cap and trade programs that have been passed is the air quality program that's embedded in a part of this work.
Mendoza says the 2021 HEAL Act established the Environmental Justice Council, which will play an important role in shaping this law.
What we're going for is essentially a culture shift in how state government interacts with underrepresented communities, overburdened communities. Instead of being kind of an external stakeholder, how are we bringing them in to be a partner in this process so their concerns are baked into all these policies from the beginning?
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A jury in Florida voted to give the Parkland mass shooter who killed 17 students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018 life in prison without parole, not the death penalty. Three jurors out of the 12 voted against a death penalty sentence. Parents and community members of those lost in the mass shooting voiced immediate outcry, saying that the jury had failed them and their lost children. In Florida, a death sentence requires a unanimous jury, and sources say one juror was a hard no on a death sentence from the beginning, saying they believed the shooter was mentally ill. He pled guilty to 17 counts of murder and was sentenced to a life sentence without parole for each one. Florida law allows for 8 different types of mitigating factors in a sentencing proceeding to disqualify the death penalty, but it isn't clear yet which of those mitigating factors swayed the jurors. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. We're interviewing author, herbalist, and forager Lisa M. Rose about her new book, Urban Foraging. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Eco Justice Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will continue to have warmth in the sun with clear skies and a high of 79. Multnomah County continues to have an air quality advisory because of wildfire smoke through 6 p.m. tomorrow. Today in history, in 1821, the Declaration of Independence of the Mexican Empire was publicly proclaimed. It's one of Mexico's founding documents declaring their independence from the Spanish Empire. The quote of the day is from American author and social critic Bell Hooks, who wrote in her book All About Love, New Visions, quote, "Ultimately, cynicism is the mask of a disappointed and betrayed heart." The January 6th committee holds its final hearing, and a Florida Republican wants $33 billion in relief for Hurricane Ian. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They're going to simply show the rest of their hand, or they're still debating among themselves what to do with this final hearing.
CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane explains a review of evidence at today's final January 6th committee hearing. No witnesses are scheduled to appear. Since July, the committee has interviewed more members of former President Donald Trump's cabinet and received a trove of Secret Service communication leading up to the Capitol riot. Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio wants $33 billion to aid in the recovery from Hurricane Ian.
We will fight for the money, as we've supported for other states, that is needed for emergency relief. Money that's going to be spent now, not money that's going to be spent 5 years from now.
All 16 of Florida's GOP members of Congress voted against the recently approved stopgap funding bill, which had $19 billion in FEMA disaster aid, though not specifically dedicated to Ian recovery. The Treasury is investigating Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' migrant transports to determine if the Republican improperly used COVID-19 aid. State lawmakers had directed $12 million in interest earned from COVID-19 aid to be used to transport unauthorized people from Florida, not necessarily from other states like Texas. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones was ordered to pay $965 million to the families of Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victims. Families accused Jones of pushing the lie that the 2012 shooting spree didn't occur. Jones admitted during the hearing he was wrong. Pennsylvania Democratic Senate nominee John Fetterman weighed in on the controversy surrounding the effects of a stroke he suffered in May, asserting his cognitive function and memory have been unaffected.
There's no secret that sometimes I'm going to miss words, and sometimes I'm going to mush two words together, and that's the truth.
Fetterman's fitness to serve has come into question as NBC News reported it used closed captioning equipment to assist him in a recent interview. Early voting is underway in several states. Civic groups urge planning how and when to vote. Piney Chiaron with the Arizona chapter of the League of Women Voters says the website vote411.org provides clear, unbiased information.
This is an easy way in which they can find out what is that ballot initiative mean. If I vote yes, what does it mean? If I vote no, what does it mean? And people who support it, what are they saying? And people who oppose it, what are they saying?
The California Attorney General launched an independent investigation into the Los Angeles City Council over the city's redistricting process. The move comes on the heels of leaked audio of three council members scheming to protect Latino political strength in council districts. Racist language was used, including accusations council member Michael Bonin used his young black son as an, quote, accessory.
My husband and I are both raw and angry and heartbroken and sick.
for our family and for Los Angeles.
Some council members have stepped down. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A Montana judge delivers an important verdict that's a victory for Native and other disenfranchised voters. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. A content warning for our listeners, today's National Native News headlines contains a story about rape.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Montana district court has struck down three election laws that could have created barriers to voting weeks before the midterm election. Eric Tigetoff has more.
Two of those laws presented especially high hurdles to Native Americans in the state. That includes a law that got rid of Election Day voter registration and another that banned third-party ballot collection. Jacqueline DeLeon is staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, which represented plaintiffs in this case. She says Judge Michael Moses found evidence that the legislature intentionally discriminated against folks who rely on Election Day registration, such as indigenous communities and students.
It's pretty disturbing that the legislature went ahead and passed these laws despite the known impacts on Native Americans.
The lawsuit was brought by Western Native Voice and tribes in Montana, including the Blackfeet Nation and Northern Cheyenne Tribe. The third law struck down in the decision would have made it harder for students to register to vote by requiring them to use another form of identification in addition to their student ID. DeLeon says a court struck down a nearly identical ballot collection law in 2020 in Montana. She says many tribes don't have reliable residential mail delivery.
They've really come to rely on organizations that go out in vehicles that can access the poor roads and can pay for gas and can travel significant distances to circumvent poor mail service to pick up ballots for Native Americans.
DeLeon says it's important to note that these laws are discriminatory, and also, on the flip side, that Native Americans are not asking for extra accommodations.
They're not asking for more than what other Montanans are entitled to. What they're asking for is for equal access. And in the face of it being unequal, they're asking that the tools that they use to overcome those inequalities not be targeted and taken away.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A settlement has reportedly been reached between the U.S. government and victims of former Indian Health Service doctor and convicted pedophile Stanley Weber. The Wall Street Journal reports the government will pay somewhere between $1 million to $2 million each to eight victims. The lawsuit against the government claims the Indian Health Service ignored or tolerated Weber's abuse. Weber worked for IHS for more than 20 years. The former pediatrician was convicted of raping and sexually assaulting boys that he treated in South Dakota and Montana. In 2020, at age 71, he was sentenced to a string of life sentences in prison. The settlement has not been finalized. A Native woman-owned business is now open on the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center's Business and Cultural District in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A ribbon-cutting ceremony was held this week for Itality Plant-Based Foods. The business focuses on culturally relevant Pueblo foods. Owner Tina Archuleta is a social entrepreneur, community doula, and chef. She says her life has always centered around wellness in Native communities.
I started my business on foot years ago around Jemez Sally Enchiladas. And that just developed and developed and developed into what we see here today. So it's been a long journey, maybe 16 years of trying and dreaming of this. So plant-based Pueblo food, it's culturally relevant food, food that we know and love, but made completely plant-based. No dairy, no eggs, no animal byproducts.
Growing up in a remote area, Archuleta faced challenges being in a food desert with difficulty finding healthy food options. She started a catering business and delivered healthy foods to tribal communities and gas stations. Now her Grab and Go is a storefront on the plaza owned by the 19 Pueblos of New Mexico. The plaza includes two hotels, a handful of eateries, a bank, and is growing with the planned food co-op and other businesses. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
President Joe Biden has designated the first national monument of his administration, and it's in Colorado. Eric Galatas has the details.
President Joe Biden was in Colorado yesterday to designate the Camp Hale Continental Divide area north of Leadville as a national monument. Soldiers from Camp Hale are credited with helping turn the tide against fascism in Europe during World War II. Bradley Noon is a 10th Mountain Division veteran and explains that the Army recruited the nation's top mountaineering and ski athletes and brought them to the Rocky Mountains to learn how to be soldiers.
The 10th Mountain trained at Camp Hale and then were deployed to Italy and were able to take a number of key points in the landscape that the Germans thought were unclimbable, unconquerable, until they met the 10th Mountain Division.
Soldiers returning from combat helped found Colorado's world-renowned ski industry, putting the state on a path to becoming a leader in harnessing the economic power of the outdoor recreation economy. According to a recent poll, 86% of Coloradans across party lines support the president designating new national monuments to protect public lands from future development, but some Republicans have called the move a land grab. In 2020, outdoor recreation contributed nearly $10 billion to Colorado's economy, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Nancy Kramer with the 10th Mountain Division Foundation calls the designation a big win for gateway towns and businesses and believes it will bring even more visitors to the area.
These cultural tourists, they come, they stay, they explore, they spend more by staying longer and engaging with the communities more. So it has a very important economic impact.
Noon says after combat tours in Afghanistan, spending time in Colorado's wild spaces probably saved his life. He says visiting the pristine area surrounding Camp Hale also helps him reconnect with the lands he signed up to protect.
Public lands act as my church. They act as my therapist, my playground, my gym. That gives me a chance to go out and see some really peaceful, quiet, tranquil, serene places that I can go and other veterans can go to heal.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Extreme heat waves are stunting kids' growth in West Africa. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A recent study of children in West Africa shows that extreme heat can worsen malnutrition and, over time, stunt kids' growth. The reasons are complex. Extreme heat can cause crop failures that reduce the availability of food and increase poverty, and it can increase the prevalence of disease.
So we took kind of a step back and looked at how extreme heat is affecting child malnutrition through all kind of possible mechanisms.
That's researcher Sylvia Blom. While at Cornell University, she was part of a team that studied more than 32,000 infants and young children in West Africa. The team found that exposure to extreme heat over a child's life decreases their vertical growth. When temperatures rose above 95 degrees Fahrenheit for about 12 days per month, the prevalence of stunting increased by 18%. And in the short term, more hot days were associated with low weight from acute malnutrition.
These effects are already occurring at current levels, and the temperatures are already rising.
So she warns that without climate action, extreme heat could slow or even reverse efforts to improve child malnutrition in the region. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 13th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Jeffrey Wade, and Sherry Morish. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Eric Gladys, Mary Sherman, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth. We're speaking with the author of the new book, Urban Foraging.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on KABU In Depth News. I'm Sherry Morish, and today I have the absolute honor of interviewing author, herbalist, and forager Lisa M. Rose. With a background in anthropology and a professional focus on community health, Lisa has a new book coming out today called Urban Foraging. It's a guide to urban foraging, to finding plants in the urban environment that you can take home and cook up or raise in your own urban garden. There are so many things to think about, and I am going to let Lisa tell us about all of these in our interview coming up. Stay tuned, and thank you for listening. KABU In Depth News. Hello, Lisa, and thank you for joining us on KABU In Depth News. I'm so happy to have you here and talk with you about your new book, Urban Foraging, coming out today. I have some questions for you, so here we go. How do you define urban foraging, and what does it entail?
Yeah, great question. So urban foraging, as I define it, really is knowing what is in our landscape in the cities and how nature can be around us all the time. We don't have to escape to Mount Hood or out into, you know, the rural areas, beautiful areas in Oregon, by the way, lovely. Yes. But nature really is just all around us. And even this morning, as I took some time and recentered myself to think about where I was at, you know, waking up in Portland, very different than the Great Lakes. Yes. I